Hello there, and thank you for joining me. This is Daniel Talks About Star Wars, the show where I will be doing exactly that. I am the titular Daniel, and today is the 1st of December, 2020. And for the last few years now, that's usually meant that in a few weeks from now, a new Star Wars film will be coming out. Unfortunately, that's not the case this year. The Skywalker saga has concluded, at least for now, with Episode 9, and we're waiting until, I think it's 2023 now. I think Taika Waititi's film is the next one slated. I could be wrong on that, but either way, it's a few years down the line, and with the way things are going in the world at the moment, who knows if that could be pushed back any further. But despite there being no new Star Wars this Christmas, at least not in the cinemas, I can't help but still feel slightly Star Wars-y this winter. And I thought, hey, why not do what I love and talk about some Star Wars, because the internet needs more white men talking about Star Wars. So this will just be a personal project of mine, a creative outlet to sort of get out my thoughts and feelings about that galaxy far, far away, that galaxy that I love so much. And I suppose before I dive right in with today's topic, I should maybe just talk about my history with Star Wars. It's always been part of my life, really. I don't have any first memory of Star Wars. When I was, you know, maybe as young as 3, I remember having a double pack of The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones on VHS that I would watch religiously. And that would have been, if I was as young as 3, that would have been 2003. So I did grow up with the prequels. I do very vaguely remember seeing Revenge of the Sith in the cinema in 2005, but of course I would have only been 5 at the time, so it's mostly just brief flashes, images that I can recall from that. And from then I just, you know, I grew up loving it. I played Lego Star Wars with my brother. I played Star Wars in the playground with my friends. I had Lego toys, you know, all of that sort of stuff. I saw the Clone Wars film when that came out, and then tried to watch the Clone Wars series as often as I could. Sometimes it was quite difficult to catch. And then, of course, I remember when it was announced that Disney had purchased Lucasfilm and we were getting a whole new trilogy. I think that was back in 2012, wasn't it? I remember hearing J.J. Abrams get announced as director for Episode 7, which I was very excited about. I remember that first photo of the table read, all that build-up to the Force Awakens. This new trilogy was a really exciting time. And then, of course, I was there opening night for The Force Awakens. It was the day before my birthday in 2015, before I turned 16. So we went there on the evening after school. I went with my mum and my brother. And then I attended the midnight releases for Rogue One, The Last Jedi, Solo and The Rise of Skywalker. And those are all memories, experiences that I will carry forever. They're, you know, very, very precious to me. I love Star Wars, and I love being able to share it with, you know, people that are close to me. One good friend of mine in particular, also named Daniel, who I did watch Last Jedi, Solo, and The Rise of Skywalker. We both went to the midnight screenings together. When we watched The Last Jedi, it was a double bill, and then I remember saying it could have even been the next day. It probably was after we saw Episode 8 that, you know, if they were going to do a triple bill for when Episode 9 came out, then of course we'd have to go and see it. And they did, so we went to the triple bill for that last year. Yeah, and that pretty much brings us up to now. I try and consume as much of the, the other media as much as I can. You know, the games, the books, comics, anything like that. I'm not quite as, if you want to say, hardcore about that kind of stuff. You know, I won't consume everything, just the things that I know or what I think will appeal to me. So, you know, I'm not the kind of fan that's read every book and every comic, but, you know, just the ones that interest me. You know, because there's a lot of content out there. I'm impressed by anyone who can keep up with all of it. But yeah, so I just thought I'd give this a go so I can share my thoughts, you know, about all things Star Wars. If this pays off and I, you know, stay committed, then I'm planning to talk about anything and everything, really, that, you know, that I can get my hands on, that I want to talk about, you know. So not just films, but the, you know, the TV shows, the games, books, as I said, you know, just anything like that that I enjoy and I want to talk about, I will talk about. But of course, to begin with, you can't not start with the films. So I thought I'd go through each film in release order for the, 10 episodes. Is it 10? No, it's 11, isn't it? Yeah, 9 and the 2 spin-offs. So, ooh, unless I want to count the Clone Wars. Oh, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it. So for these first episodes, I'll cover all the films, and what better place to start at the beginning? 1977, A New Hope. Obviously, at the time, it was just known as Star Wars, but we've all come to know it as Episode 4. And for a very long time, this was my favourite Star Wars film. And to be honest, this is going to sound like negativity straight out the gate. It's not, although it is going to sound that way. Having watched it again yesterday, as I record this, I really can't figure out why it is my favourite, because it doesn't really contain any of the elements that I would say today appeal to me in a Star Wars film. And that is, as I'm saying that sounds crazy now. Of course, it's you know, it's a Star Wars film, but as I get into, you know, what I want to talk about as we go on, that'll become sort of what I mean will become clearer. But, you know, just as I watched it last night, because I would place it now if I were to rank the films, and perhaps I'll do that as these episodes go on, but if I were to rank it now, it would definitely be sort of in the middle of the list, I think. It's by no means my favourite now. Of course, I still love it, and it's a fantastic film, but in regards to the Star Wars filmography, it's lacking in a few areas for me, and it's just interesting, because I really did hold that opinion for a very long time. I would always say, yeah, A New Hope, that's my favourite, but yeah, it's just interesting to look back and, you know, try and think, well, what was it that made it my favourite, because I'm struggling to recognise now what those reasons could have been, but I'm rambling, so let's get in to the film. So after the, of course, the immediately iconic, you know, Star Wars title, the crawl, that music, it's amazing to me how well the special effects hold up. You know, this is a 43-year-old film at this point, and I mean, obviously, I watched it on Disney Plus, so I think it's like the 4K remaster, so obviously, with the help of various touch-ups, I'm sure. But still, the effects are just incredible, that model work, and it's not lost on me just how revolutionary that must have been at the time. And, you know, I try and put yourself in the mindset of somebody in the cinema in 1977, and seeing that for the first time, it must have really blown minds, because even now, you know, I watch it, and it holds up just so well. It looks, you know, immediately you can see why this film, especially this one, I think, is just timeless. And just it will forever be a classic, I think. And you can see how people's imaginations were captured and why it really just, you know, took off the way it did. And of course, I'm talking about the opening shots with the Star Destroyer chasing after the Tantive IV. You get that scale of the Star Destroyer compared to the Rebel ship, and it's just, and not only does it look great, but of course we immediately get the sense of, you know, we know what's going on with the rebels, the underdogs. They're in this tiny ship, and of course they're being swallowed up by this massive, you know, looming empire, you know, so immediately, you know, the storytelling is on point, and then we transition inside the ship. And it was quite interesting, I noticed this time when watching it, something that I'd never really paid attention to before, but the interior design of the Tantive IV, it's quite empire in the way that it's just so plain, so, you know, it's just these white walls, and it's interesting, because I think so much of this film is visually conveyed, you know, through the costumes, through, you know, other sets, you know, like in the Death Star corridors, things like that. You look at something and you sort of immediately get this idea. A lot of the stuff is very simplistic, and that's not to say it's bad or anything, of course, I'm not saying that. But a lot of the, you look at Princess Leia, for example, her costume, you immediately understand who she is supposed to be, even if you don't have all the finer details, you get the idea straight away. And that's the same, of course, with Darth Vader, this black armoured giant. It's the same with Ben, you know, the hooded hermit wizard type characters, you know, so it's just interesting here that I looked at the Tantive IV, and it you know, it's iconic in its design, but it doesn't exactly line up with a lot of the other stuff in the film that is so on point in terms of its design. But it's not an issue. It is just something I sort of picked up on this this time round. We meet C-3PO and R2-D2, characters that carry on throughout the entire saga. And then we see the big man himself, Darth Vader, who... And looking at Darth Vader, looking at the stormtroopers, you can see that the budget compared to, obviously, the sequels, is not quite there. You know, Darth Vader is all matte, you know, compared to the later films. He's so shiny, so, you know, glossy. And then you look at all the stormtroopers, and there's so many inconsistencies throughout their armors and their helmets. You know, you really get the idea that things behind the scenes are, like, barely being held together by tape. You know, it's you know, the cracks are almost showing, but it makes the film very, very charming. I think the film is very quaint in that way, and it's interesting again to try and think back to 1977 when people would be seeing this for the first time. And this was, you know, this film was the underdog. Nobody thought it was going to succeed, and that's kind of reflective, you know, in you know, some minor aspects of the production. Again, I think this film holds up remarkably well, you know, that's why it's timeless the way it is, but there are a few cracks showing, and it is interesting to see. Moving on, we have Princess Leia giving R2-D2 the Death Star plans, the iconic shot. Him and C-3PO obviously escape the Tantive IV, they head for Tatooine, and I do want to mention just here that I love C-3PO. I've never been a big R2-D2 fan. I know he's the favourite among the two of them, but I love 3PO, and it pains me when people say that he's annoying in this film, or in any of the films, really, and that people don't like him, because I really enjoy him. But as they escape, we have one of the many, how should we say, nitpicks. They are nitpicks when those Imperial officers don't shoot down that escape pod, which has never really bothered me. In my head canon, the guy that says, "Hold your fire," could have been a rebel spy anyway. That was always how I justified it in my head. Not that it needed justifying, really, because it's not a big deal. If they shot it down, we wouldn't have a film. But I think since then, if I'm remembering correctly, the From a Certain Point of View book has rectified it anyway. But we get some interactions between Darth Vader and Princess Leia, and we see Vader interacting with some of his troops, and it's here that I was reminded about a big problem I have with Darth Vader. And this is with any time that he pops up, really. And I've got nothing against David Prowse. I'm sure he's a lovely man, and I have a signed Darth Vader helmet from him, so nothing against the man, but I am not a fan of the way he portrays Vader physically. I know, you know, we owe him a lot, of course, because without him, then there is no man behind the mask, but I don't like how pointy he is. I've never really liked that. He's far too expressive, I think, with his body. And I know it must be difficult to try and convey personality and try and act through a suit like that, but just the way he points, it's always come across as inconsistent with how his character actually behaves. But, you know, that's a minor thing. It is what it is, but that's just a personal feeling. And we make it to Tatooine with the droids, and we spend an awfully long time there. But this is where I must make a confession. When I was a child, despite claiming A New Hope to be my favourite Star Wars film, I would always, without fail, skip forward until we meet Luke when I was a kid. I would always just move right past all this droid stuff. And even now, when I was watching it last night, you know, I could feel myself wanting to reach for my phone. You know, it's not bad or anything, because, you know, it is over pretty quickly, but compared to the rest of the film, it is a bit of a drag in comparison. I know that, you know, that's heresy. How could I possibly skip? But, you know, I'm here to be honest. I'm here to give my true opinions. But of course, the droids are captured by Jawas. They're taken aboard the Sandcrawler, which I love the design of. I know it's just this big block on treads, but there's just something about it that I love. And I thought, again, the model work looked really good. I mean, you know, this could all just be me looking at all this stuff through rose-tinted glasses, but honestly, I looked at that Sandcrawler and I was like, yeah, that looks like a massive vehicle moving through the desert. You know, the model work is pretty flawless in this film, I think. And it kind of adds to that idea that I kind of brought up earlier with the design of so much of this film. There's just a simplicity to everything that I think no other Star Wars film really has. And in that way, I think it is a lot more reminiscent of a sort of fairy tale compared to the other films in the series. And I think for that reason and for other reasons that I'll bring up later as we get to them, this definitely feels less like Star Wars as we know it. It is a different kind of thing. It's not Star Wars as it is now, obviously, because this was the genesis. It is a lot more this space fantasy, this fairy tale, and not the brand, if that makes any sense at all. I feel like when we get on to the next one, when we move on to Empire, that is much more where the groundwork was laid for what Star Wars would become and what it would go on to be. But I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll talk about that next week, hopefully. But after spending some time with the droids, we see that the Empire has gotten wind of the plans, potentially having made it to this desert planet, and it's here that we see the first notable, at least, special edition changes, which I know have been a controversial topic in the past. I'm sure for a lot of people they still are. But being born in 1999, as I was, and sort of growing up on the prequels, the special editions are all I've ever known. I think it was 1997, wasn't it, when the special edition changes were first sort of implemented. I think it was the re-release, wasn't it? And so yeah, the special editions are all I've ever known, and because of that, they don't really bother me. I think from the viewpoint of consistency and, you know, the whole argument of preserving art in its original form, I would prefer them to be the theatrical cuts, but again, because it's all I've ever known, they don't really faze me in the slightest. I think it's just a shame that, especially with how impressive I found the model work and the other special effects on this rewatch, it is a shame that it's then kind of juxtaposed with this very dated CGI. And it is obvious, you know, that you there's no... But again, it's just something, because it's always been that way for me, it's not something I have a strong feeling about. It's just, you know, in hindsight, yes, I would rather it not be there, but I don't have any strong feelings towards it, because it's that is how I know this original trilogy. And there are changes that I do like and that I do prefer from the original cut. So in the grand scheme of things, I am grateful for the changes. But that's more in the other two, I think, in 5 and 6. In this film, there is an awful lot of just added creatures and added spaceships, like things like just things that have just been put in using pretty bad CGI. So of course, I forgot to mark down a time for this. I was planning on doing it, but I didn't. So it feels quite late into the film. We're introduced to our protagonist, Luke Skywalker, and Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, who I just want to say on the record that I really like Uncle Owen. And I know that he's real crusty and kind of unfair on Luke, but I really like that guy. And it's a shame what happened to him, we'll say for now. But yeah, and all the stuff with Luke is really good. You know, obviously we have that young kid that just, you know, is wishing for more before he sets out on this adventure. But also when he's talking with his aunt and uncle, and they have a few brief hints towards his father. And it's just interesting that the eventual twist in the next one, obviously, that Darth Vader is his father. Spoilers, sorry. Which I don't think was set in stone at the time of this film. It's interesting that these kind of hints work out well enough. And then a bit later with Obi-Wan as well, which I'll talk about when we get to him. And then, of course, we come on to what is potentially the single most iconic image from the saga. That's debatable, but it's definitely one of the most iconic images. The binary sunset. And yeah, I think if there's a shot that could sum up what Star Wars is about, or especially what this film in particular is about, it can all be summed up in that single shot, that Luke just looking off into the horizon at those suns. It's a really powerful image, and I can't believe I've gone this long talking about the genius that is John Williams. Here, of course, we get this the lovely rendition of the Force theme. And yeah, just his... So much of his music in this film is just fantastic. This is by no means my favourite score, and I think his music does improve in later films. But here, you can't deny that, you know, I mean, we've got the Force theme, we've got Princess Leia's theme, which is beautiful, we've got the main title, of course. You know, these are all immediately iconic, and they continue even as late as, you know, last year's film, Episode 9, you know, 40 plus years later. So, you know, it's a testament to his talent and the iconicness of his music that it, you know, it persists all these years later and is, and it's just so well realized in this film as well. But, you know, having said that, noticeably absent is the Imperial March. That, I mean, that wouldn't come in until the next film. And I think small things like that, you know, aspects that, you know, like the Imperial March that have also become so iconic, when those are missing from this film, I think that's what I mean when I'm saying that this film, A New Hope, isn't quite the Star Wars we know yet. You know, that kind of, it's obviously, you know, being the first film, it's finding its feet, and I think that is noticeable when you sort of compare it to other films in the franchise. After the binary sunset, we have R2-D2, who's gone on the run, looking for this mysterious Obi-Wan Kenobi character that we have heard about on Princess Leia's message. And not too long after that, we meet the man himself. And firstly, I've got to talk about that crate dragon scream, which this isn't even a special edition change. I mean, I think it was changed for the special edition, but it's been reimagined again. I think this was for the 2011 Blu-ray re-release. Just this awful, quite frightening sound that obviously Obi-Wan is imitating to scare away the sand people. But what they've done with it, with that most recent change, is just terrible. It's a really out of place and really over the top sound, which I do not like. I will go on the record and say that is a change that I dislike tremendously. But that is a change from what I knew, even from the already changed special editions. So, you know, a lot of love for Star Wars, of course, just comes from what you know and what you grew up with. We have the introduction of one of my favourite characters, particularly this incarnation, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Ben. Played wonderfully by Alec Guinness, who, for a man that hated Star Wars as much as he did, he's not half bad in this film. And yeah, I love him. And that shot where he reveals himself, where he pulls down his hood and he speaks to R2, I love it. That's one of my favourite shots in the entire saga. It's just so magical to me. And I love that music that plays as well when... I think when Luke first mentions the name Obi-Wan, and you have those, what is it? I think it's just a, well, I'm not even going to try and guess what it is. It's a wind instrument. I'm sure people that know the film like I do know what I'm talking about. Just that, it's good, man. And yeah, and then we go back to Obi-Wan's house, and he's telling Luke about the Jedi, about the Force. He mentions the Clone Wars, and I wonder what it must have been like to be hearing all of this for the first time, and what people's first sort of, you know, theories about what the Clone Wars were, and like what the Force could do, sort of what it was, what the Jedi were like. You know, it's just so difficult to place yourself in the mindset of when this first came out, and just what people must have thought about it, and what people's immediate, you know, when people heard Jedi for the first time, what kind of images did that conjure up? What did people immediately understand about the Force? You know, did people think that it could make lightning shoot out your fingertips? Or, you know, I mean, it's just such an interesting way to look at it, you know, to imagine a world without Star Wars. You know, how just insane. And Luke is asking more about his father again. That wonderful moment where Alec Guinness, he has that pause before he tells Luke the lie about Darth Vader having killed his father. that's so good in, because at the time, I'm sure it was something that people wouldn't have read into too much. It was probably more intended from Guinness at you know, when they were filming it, that it, he was just hesitant to tell Luke about his father being murdered. But, you know, in retrospect, having, since the prequels have come out, you can read so much into that tiny moment, that pause where he's getting ready to tell this lie, and, you know, maybe he's debating whether or not to actually tell him the truth. And, you know, it's a great little moment, and it's been retroactively enhanced by what's come after it as well, which I think is really sort of fascinating. And it was at this point as well that I began thinking to myself, my God, we have not seen the Empire in a while. It is really quite a large chunk of the film just spent with Luke away from sort of all of that stuff that we were met with at the beginning. I'm not sure if it's a good or bad decision in terms of structure. That's not really for me to say. I'm sure that's just subjective. But then what do you know? In the very next scene, we do go back to the Empire. We see the Death Star for the first time, I do believe. And we meet one of my favourite Star Wars characters, who didn't become one of my favourite characters until sort of one of the more recent viewings I had of this film a couple of years ago now, because it really stood out to me just how fantastic he is. But Peter Cushing as Grand Moff Tarkin, my goodness, he is a good villain, and he is so good in that role, and oh, I just love him so much, and it's such a shame that he's only in this, well, that Peter Cushing is only in this one film. It probably made sense for him to go. I can't see a place for him in future installments, especially as the story gets obviously a lot more personal for Luke. But God, it's a crying shame. But what we get here is just fantastic, and, you know, maybe it's better to be left wanting more. And talking again a little bit about structure, I do think it's, you know, it's pretty good here how, obviously, in the previous scene to this, we learn about the Force from Obi-Wan, and then immediately we see what it can do with Darth Vader. Obviously, he chokes Admiral Motti, I do believe is his name. Just from a basic storytelling point of view, that's pretty good in my book. But I noticed here that I've never really considered just how good even the smaller parts in this film are. Like, the actors that play these minor roles, like Admiral Motti, thinking about Biggs, who I like a lot, Wedge, Dr. Evazan, like some of the characters in the cantina, like all these very minor roles are performed remarkably well, I think, considering, again, that no one had any faith in this film really whatsoever when it came out, and yet, you know, even these small background characters seem really well realized, and that kind of just stood out to me. I think Admiral Motti especially, I love that guy who plays him, he's so slimy, and so it's just really good. And, you know, and that's the same way I feel about Uncle Owen, who, unfortunately, when we return to Tatooine with Luke and Ben, has unfortunately met his maker along with his beloved wife, Beru. A really undignified end for them, just being reduced to skeletons that way. I mean, it's horrible, but it's surprisingly, I'm not sure if it entirely works. It's so unlike anything else in the film. But that gives Luke the push he needs to go off with Ben and start his adventure. So they make their way to Mos Eisley, and we of course have the iconic cantina scene with perhaps the most earwormy piece of music in the history of cinema, that cantina song, which of course is great, it's iconic. But a little hot take of mine here, I actually prefer the second cantina song. That's much more my jam. One thing I did think here that doesn't feel quite right is how quickly Obi-Wan kind of springs into action when Dr. Evazan sort of throws Luke across the cantina. I know, obviously, Obi-Wan did try to calm him down, you know, he was being his charming self, offering to buy him a drink, but the way he just immediately goes from that to whipping out his lightsaber, severing poor old Pundababa's arms. Well, just his one arm. Yeah, that didn't entirely ring true, I don't think. Just the way, obviously, Obi-Wan's been in exile all these years. I feel like they probably just wanted an excuse to show a lightsaber in action, kind of like in that previous scene with Obi-Wan. He first tells Luke about the Force. The next scene, we see Darth Vader use the Force. Similarly, I think here, obviously, we are first introduced to the lightsaber in that same scene. Maybe they thought, well, we best show what this weapon can do. But yeah, it just doesn't entirely ring true to his character that he would be so careless to just whip that out and, you know, start cutting off some limbs. But again, it's not a massive deal, but it did stand out to me on this rewatch. And of course, we meet Han Solo and Chewbacca, you know, two just iconic cinema. I've said that word a lot during this, but it's true, you know, this is just full of icons. But yeah, Han Solo, played wonderfully by Harrison Ford. Peter Mayhew playing Chewie. What can you say about Han Solo? He was my favourite character for a long time when I was a kid. I'm sure he's it might not be controversial to say most people's favourite character in Star Wars, I think, if you were to ask a general audience. And yeah, he's just effortlessly cool. And yeah, it's like he was born to play that role. He's fantastic. And from there, we move on to another controversial change surrounding the special editions, the whole hand shot first thing. Again, obviously, having grown up on the special editions, I've always known it to be that Greedo, they essentially shoot at the same time, although Greedo does technically shoot first and Han sort of reacts. But I think even then, and I know people's complaints about that is that it kind of messes with Han Solo's arc, sort of going from this rogue outlaw type character that would shoot someone first and unprovoked to then obviously becoming a hero at the end of the film. I can see people's arguments how this special edition change, having Greedo shoot Han first. I see that argument, how it would change, how it could affect his arc, but from my point of view, having grown up with that change and only knowing that change, it doesn't affect his arc in the slightest, I don't think. My interpretation of that scene has always been, you know, maybe he technically didn't shoot first, but he basically, I don't think the impact of the scene is lost. I think just because Greedo shoots a millisecond before Han does, I still think it does come across the way that it wasn't originally intended to. I've always interpreted the scene the way that people say it can't be interpreted anymore because of the change, if that makes sense. So I don't think it's a big deal. And that actually leads us into another change, which is the addition of the Jabba scene, which wasn't in the original. It was deleted. Jabba was filmed as just a human, and just they had an actor and it was just a guy. Obviously, they've redone it. They've added in a CG Jabba. They've got that crazy, why did they do it, walk over the tail that Han does, which does look just terrible. But again, not to sound like a broken record, but having only ever known that scene to be in there, it doesn't bother me. It bothers me that there is a CGI slug in this film from 1977. But again, I can look past it just because it's all I've ever known. So we finally leave Tatooine. We've got our pilot. We're in the Millennium Falcon. The team, the crew is coming together. And we have Luke. He's on the Falcon. He's training against that probe droid. And it was here that I sort of had the thought, just realised just how quiet and how passive the Force is portrayed in this film. You know, with Luke sort of being able to deflect the blaster bolts, you know, being able to focus himself like that. The way that Obi-Wan just influences, obviously, the Stormtrooper with the mind trick. The way Vader chokes Mutti earlier in the scene, which obviously is a lot more aggressive than the other examples I've used. But still, pretty low-key, quite small scale. The Force is definitely used more as a way that somebody kind of can enhance something that they could already do. You know, it's only, it's very quiet, as I said, very passive in that way. And it's just interesting, obviously, comparing it to later when things, you know, get a lot more, when things get a lot more like the Force is a superpower, basically, you know, as it can come across in some of the later films. It's just interesting to see it in this different way in this film, you know, at the beginning. And in that same way, I think just the film as a whole is so much, so small scale. You know, there's so much less of the kind of the planet hopping, which of course, you know, it would be down to, you know, budget reasons and all that kind of thing in terms of the production. But I just mean, you know, it's so self-contained in a way that other films in the saga aren't. And that again, just, you know, reinforces my feeling that this is so different, so unlike Star Wars as we've come to know it. But our heroes are taken aboard the Death Star, the Millennium Falcon is captured, Alderaan before that has been destroyed, and we have some really good chemistry between all the leads, with Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, before Leia comes along. They're really good together. And then obviously when Leia is introduced to the mix, she's fantastic. They really are an excellent trio, and they bounce off each other so well. And it's all just good fun. It's adventure, you know, aboard this whole Death Star sequence. It's just really enjoyable. You know, it's just pure entertainment. With the exception, in my opinion, of the trash compactor scene. When they go down there, I think the trash compactor scene is so pointless and so just time-wasting that I've never liked it. If I could change anything about this film, I would get rid of it. And I know that's probably very controversial, but it's true. That scene has never sat right with me. But following on from that, we continue on with the shenanigans aboard the Death Star, and we have our first ever lightsaber duel in the history of Star Wars, and I don't think it's controversial to say that it's probably the worst one. You know, you can't deny that it is a little bad, you know, with old Alec Guinness kind of trying to be an action hero. You know, in terms of choreography, it's not exactly top tier. You know, I did think in its own way it was rather striking seeing these, you know, everything around them is so sort of drab. And I don't mean bad in a way. It's obviously the, you know, the interior of the Death Star is intentionally designed that way. But, you know, you got Darth Vader, he's all in black. Obi-Wan isn't exactly wearing the most colourful outfit, you know, it's all these quite earthy colours. And then you have these two sort of splashes of colour, this red blade and the blue. And it is actually a very nice visual. And I can imagine people, for all the fight's faults, I can imagine that it kind of did make people perk up a bit in their seats, you know. I'm sure, well, given the reactions to this film at the time, I'm sure people were already perked. But if they could perk any more, then I'm sure it did, you know. I'm sure it was quite thrilling at the time. It of course ends with Ben's demise, not entirely, just in the physical world. And I suppose that is the most extravagant thing that the Force sort of does in this film, obviously, sort of it confirms a sort of afterlife in this universe, which again, it's not the, you know, the craziest concept or anything. And obviously in this one, he is just a disembodied voice. He can't do anything except tell Luke to run, and he does, and they escape aboard the Falcon, and we get our first dogfight, and it's pretty good. It's helped a lot by John Williams' music, but I think it's a good bit of action and a nice change of pace. We've had a lot of running through corridors, you know, for the last big portion of the film, so it's, you know, it's nice to change it up a bit and have some, you know, different kind of action. And it concludes with a pretty funny moment as well, which is something I do want to quickly touch on. It's so difficult when you know a film as well as I, and I'm sure, you know, many, many other people sort of know this one. When something is so deeply ingrained within you, it is difficult to try and kind of actually figure out what your opinion is on anything. Like, obviously, I look, I love this film, but it's difficult to try and articulate how I feel about a lot of it, just because I know it so well to the point where everything just is, if that makes any sense. And so when it comes to certain aspects like humour, I don't necessarily find it funny most of the time, because they are just dialogue exchanges that I know are about to happen, and I know that Han's going to say this and Luke is going to respond with this, and it's difficult to actually appreciate those kind of moments as actually being funny. I hope I'm making sense, I hope people sort of know what I'm trying to say. But when I watched it last night, you know, I did have a little giggle to myself with when that dogfight concludes and there's that exchange when Han is saying, you know, do you think a princess and a guy like me, and Luke just cuts him off. No. You know, that's good. And it you kind of have to, or at least I, you know, have to kind of take a step back for a moment and think, oh yeah, that's actually quite funny. But yeah, we make it to Yavin 4, which is quite the change of pace. You know, the rebel base, it's inside this temple, this ancient kind of structure. It's so different to anything else we've seen in the film, or at least for a while. You know, not since we've been on Tatooine have we had an environment, you know, even close to something like this. And again, just going back to what I said earlier about the design of the Tantive IV, it's, you know, that is so different to what we get with the rebels here, obviously, with the this environment that's a lot more natural than obviously what we get on the Star Destroyers on the Death Star. So that's sort of what I meant earlier when I said that the Tantive IV is a lot more reminiscent of sort of Imperial designs, because comparing it to the base on Yavin 4, it does stand out. And I will admit, when General Dodonna is kind of giving the briefing about the Death Star and what's going to happen, I know it needs to happen because we need to find out exactly what the plan is and what the weaknesses in the Death Star. So I know it's information that we need, but I will admit it does feel like a bit of a drag, especially having come from, you know, just action, you know, shooting, Death Star, dogfight, you know, having come from all of that, and suddenly we're just at this old man and he's pointing at a screen. It does feel like putting the brakes on just a little bit, but it's soon over. You know, it's only a short scene, but it was noticeable to me. And I'm going to take this moment in the episode to just let anyone who's listening know that I love, love, love Y-Wings. They are my favourite Star Wars spaceship. X-Wings, get them out of here. I don't want them. Y-Wings all the way. I just want that to be on the record. We have yet another special edition with the inclusion of the Biggs scene. Biggs Darklighter, obviously Luke's friend from back on Tatooine. There's a whole load of other deleted content as well that would have shown us more of their relationship back on Tatooine. And I do like Biggs. I like the performance by, I think it's Gavin Hammond, is it? I hope I'm getting his name right. And I do like Biggs quite a lot. He's got quite a lot of charisma. Luke and Biggs' interaction, for as brief as it is, does seem genuine. I sort of isolated, I do enjoy the scene, but I'm not sure if it really works, because it doesn't really amount to anything when the battle is going on later and Biggs does unfortunately die. There isn't anything from Luke's reaction, really, that makes the audience feel much in the way of emotion. So it is odd that they decided to go back and add that scene in, because ultimately it does kind of confuse things. I mean, initially in the theatrical cut, without it being there, because there is a reaction shot, I think, from Luke where he kind of has a brief moment where he kind of just stares into the distance after Biggs does die. So there is that quick little reaction shot, but it's not enough to really imply too much hurt from Luke. Going back and adding this in to obviously establish that connection between Luke and Biggs, it kind of makes Luke's very minimal reaction quite strange. You would have thought there would have been more. It's just strange ultimately knowing what Luke's reaction is, that they would go back and establish that relationship between them in the first place, really. But hey, I like Biggs, so seeing more of him is okay in my book. And of course, we have the Battle of Yavin, which I don't really have an awful lot to say about, except that I really like it, and I think it might be my favourite space battle in the entire saga, just because it's so focused with all of the other space battles that I can think of in my head right now across the other films. They're always secondary to something else that's going on in the plot. And I think for that reason, because this is what the film is kind of hinging on, this is the goal that we've been working towards the entire film, to use the information in the plans that we're told about, in the very opening crawl, and, using them to destroy this battle station. That's what the film's been leading up to. That is hopefully going to be the payoff of this action sequence. I think for that reason, it is the best space battle, and it, of course, ends with Han making his return after having left Yavin with his reward earlier. He comes back and saves the day with Chewie. The Death Star is destroyed. Tarkin is unfortunately killed. Darth Vader spins away into space. And yeah, it's a good, happy ending. The heroes get their medals at the end. We celebrate. It's a self-contained story, which of course it would have had to have been at the time, because they had no idea if it was going to be a success. They didn't know if they were getting a sequel. So it is just this nice... It is just a nice romp of a film. I hope I'm using the term romp correctly. it is because of that, again, I do see this one as being kind of its own thing. It does feel quite... I mean, as separate that a Star Wars film can feel, it's still very important, of course, but it does feel separate to the other films in the saga for the multitude of reasons that I have mentioned throughout this episode. But that's not a bad thing at all. It's interesting to look at it that way when comparing it to the other films. But, it is a big strength on Episode 4's part that it can exist on its own in a way that I don't think any other film in the franchise can. And as it ended, I was quite surprised as the circle closed in on that final shot, and we get the opening credits. The closing credits. And we, of course, have John Williams' incredible music. I was surprised that I actually got goosebumps, which is something that I didn't think could happen, that I was... that my body reacted in that way. Even now, after having watched this film countless times, pretty much knowing it out of all the Star Wars films, knowing this one just so inside and out, and yeah, I still felt that magic as it ended. And I think that's a testament to what I said at the start of this episode, that this is just a timeless piece of media. I think this is a classic in every sense of the word, and I really enjoyed talking about it. This has been fun for me. I guess I'm gonna wrap it up now. Thank you for listening to the first episode of Daniel Talks About Star Wars. Next week, of course, I'll be covering the next episode in the saga, Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. Really looking forward to talking about it. I hope you have enjoyed this. I'm not sure if I already said that. Yeah, I'm going to go now. Thank you, and goodbye.